The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It is approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Monday. It's the 7th of October 2024. A very good morning. How are you all keeping? I hope you had a great weekend. And it's great to have you back on board for another week of the 9 till noon show. It's the usual mix coming up of features that will keep you informed and entertained, and we want your views all along the way. Our lines are open once again. They're ever open, if the truth be told. You can text or WhatsApp us on 086 60 25000. Maybe there's a topic you believe we should be talking about. Let us know. There's no point saying, oh, why don't they talk about that? Well, we have to know about it too, so get in touch with us. If you want to give us a call, it's 07491 25000, 07491 25000. And for either of those numbers, if you're outside the Republic and you want to be in touch with us, it's 00353. You drop the O and away you go with the rest of the number. Emails come into us at comments@highlandradio.com, and you are free, if it suits you, to watch the show on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, on your mobile devices, your smart TV or your Fire Stick, across Facebook and on the X platform. The Derry People Donegal News this morning. Parishioners gathered in St Mary's Church, Remelton, on Saturday to pray for missing local man Paul Buchanan. The mass was arranged after a kayak was found north of Tory Island on Friday evening. Mr Buchanan, who operates an accounting practice in Letterkenny, failed to return after he set off from Maher Galleon Pier in Gwydor at around 5 p.m. on Thursday evening, October 3rd. A massive sea search has been ongoing since the alarm was raised at midnight on Thursday. Speaking at Mass on Saturday, Parish Priest Father Michael Carney thanked everyone for coming out in such great numbers to pray. We join in those prayers. The Derry News this morning. Police are investigating a vandalism attack on a Derry city centre business. Red paint was daubed on the front of the Oasis Gaming Centre in the Diamond area on Friday afternoon. A group called Derry Socialist Republicans for Palestine have claimed responsibility for the attack. A video on the group's Instagram page shows two members smearing paint on the front of the business before cycling off down Shipkey Street. A post on the group's Instagram page says it carried out the attack due to the owner's links to Israel and the exploitation of working class communities. That's what they claim in any case. On to the national side. The Irish Independent this morning, and fears are growing for the safety of 33 Irish peacekeeping troops trapped at a UNIFIL outpost where heavy fighting is ongoing between the Israeli army and Hezbollah. The UN has now raised concerns over the position of Israeli tanks near the peacekeeping post known as UNP 652, manned by Irish troops. In a statement last night, UNIFIL, the UN mission in Lebanon, said the presence of IDF troops there was an extremely dangerous development, of course, not least because they could be targeted themselves, drawing fire on the Irish peacekeepers. I said that, by the way, it's not in the article. The platoon of Irish soldiers have been locked down at the Irish base along the so-called Blue Line since last Monday, when the perimeter of their base was swarmed by Israeli Merkava tanks. Now, I'm not sure why they stayed on site. I know in the past Irish missions have, when there have been incursions or increased hostilities, have stayed to fulfil their mission. But this seems a particularly ruthless stage of this conflict, and I don't see what purpose they serve being there. But that could be my own ignorance. And I know there are former, I'm sure there are former members of the Defence Forces or current Defence Forces that have served in South Lebanon. And if you want to give us an insight into that, we'd be more than happy to speak to you. Well, the Israeli army dug in around the Irish base and engaged Hezbollah in heavy rocket and gunfire that has persisted throughout the weekend. Irish UN troops maintained a large base, Camp Shamrock, and two outposts along the Blue Line, the de facto border between Israel and Lebanon. And the Israelis continue to pound southern Lebanon and Beirut at night time as well, which is not an accident. Doesn't let anyone sort of settle or rest on their laurels, be they the enemy or be they just regular civilians, which are being killed in huge numbers. The Irish Times this morning, Sinn Féin is under renewed pressure to clarify when senior figures learned the party officials had provided references for a former employee who was then under police investigation and was later convicted of child sex offences. Yesterday, Taoiseach Simon Harris described as deeply worrying the revelation that two former Sinn Féin press officers provided references for a former colleague, Michael McMonagall, 42, from Limewood Street, Derry, who was convicted last month for a series of sexual offences, including attempting to incite a child to engage in sexual activity. McMonagall had sought employment with the British Heart Foundation, which was not made aware by Sinn Féin of the charges he faced. The party's Northern leader, Michelle O'Neill, has said she only became aware of the references at the time of the conviction. However, on Saturday, it emerged that the British Heart Foundation contacted Sinn Féin in August of 23 as part of a review by the charity of its recruitment process when it was made aware of the charges against McMonagall. Ms. O'Neill said she learnt last Thursday that in August 23, following media reports of charges against McMonagall, that the BHF had contacted Sinn Féin's former HR manager about the references. Somebody who actually carried out a sexual crime against a child was moved from a political party to a charity, and that move was facilitated by employer references provided by that party, Mr. Harris said. So it's a story that continues to rumble. The Irish Daily Mail this morning, the fastest population growth since the Celtic Tiger is driving strong house price increases, the latest myhome.ie report shows. And really effectively what this seems to be saying is that even if we are continuing to build at the current rate, or even to some extent the targets that have been outlined, such as the influx, the inward migration of people, some seeking refuge, some actually just seeking employment, the housing market does not have the capacity for this increased inward movement. Strong labour market growth and a population surge of 1.9% for a second successive year to 5.38 million now has put intensive pressure on the seriously undersupplied housing market. The number of properties listed for sale on myhome.ie in September was just 13,100, well down from the pre-pandemic levels of 20,000 plus and a drop of around 35%. One in seven homes are selling for 20% above their asking price, and asking prices nationally are up 7.5% on last year, the strongest increase in 2 years, according to the new report. And effectively, Ireland would need 200,000 extra homes this year alone to match the UK's housing to population ratio. Now, that's just an indication, it's a bit of guidance, but that's how far behind we are. And the current population growth compared to our ability to build houses, they're mismatched significantly at the moment. There was a bizarre story in the papers over the weekend, or maybe not so bizarre, and it's continued in the Irish Daily Star today. Revelations that an Irish politician was allegedly recruited by a Russian spy should come as no surprise to anyone, Simon Harris has said. The Fine Gael leader made the comments after reports emerged that Russian intelligence allegedly recruited an Oireachtas member as an agent. Described as one of the state's most closely guarded secrets, the politician, given the codename Cobalt, was allegedly recruited by a Russian diplomat who was also acting as a spy master. Now, if this is a true story, like at this point, surely the person's name should be mentioned. I'm not saying them not being named means the story's untrue, but there's an awful lot going on here about supposed this and alleged that, and I heard the other. It's believed Russian intelligence used a honey trap to recruit the politician as an agent during the Brexit talks, with one of the aims being to undermine relations between Britain, Ireland and the EU. The agent is alleged to have met with former diplomat Sergei Prokopev, I know that man's name and I can't pronounce it from the way it's written down, who was expelled from the country by the Department of Foreign Affairs. The Sunday Times claimed the pair met outside of Dublin and were monitored by security forces. Which is really quite a bizarre story. But who is the person? I think if the paper is so sure of who it is, they should be able to name the person. But anyway, maybe that will happen. Staying with politics, The Sun tells us that more than half of you out there want a general election this month. While the current Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil Green Party coalition can continue until early 2025, there's been speculation the next election may be called sooner. Taoiseach Simon Harris and his Fine Gael party are continuing to ride high in the polls, with the latest Sunday Independent Ireland Think poll indicating he has the highest party leader support level on 53%, while Fine Gael support is up at 26%. Mr. Harris said on Friday the next election will come in due course, while Taoiseach Micheál Martin said on Saturday the three party leaders have said they want to go the full distance. But of course, Micheál Martin perhaps would like to go the full distance, given the fact that there's probably a little bit of rebounding to be done for his party. But a poll of the public found 55% want an election to be held this month or next. So there you go. And lastly, the emotional roller coaster that the family of Danielle McLaughlin are being put through. I mean, it's just unbelievable. We spoke not so long ago to Andrea Branigan, who has been through it all in terms of losing her daughter, the circumstances of it, it being so far away, and then the foot dragging in the trial of the chief suspect, Vikat Bhagat, and then to be told, right, the end is in sight, and then for that now, again, seemingly to have been snatched away is unbelievable. The mum of backpacker, they call her a tragic backpacker, her events were tragic, but she was anything but, she was an amazing young woman. The mum of Danielle has told of her anguish after the trial of a man accused of her murder will be extended again. Andrea Branigan, whose daughter Danielle McLaughlin was killed in India in 2017, was told the seven-year legal proceedings would end on October 17th, but has learned it's been put back. The body of Danielle, who was 28 and from Buncrana, was found in Goa. She'd been brutally raped and murdered. Vikat Bhagat denies rape and murder of Danielle. He's been in custody since his trial began in 2017, now ongoing for more than 7 years. It's one of the longest murder trials in the world, believe it or not. Last year, India's High Court instructed the trial to be expedited to hearing three times a week and to be concluded by July. However, Andrea was told earlier in the summer it'll continue throughout September. And she has then been informed a new bid to have the trial continue longer was refused by the court, which ordered proceedings to conclude by October 17th. So that brings us up to date with our last conversation with Andrea. But now a judge believes it's impossible to finish by that date and requested the High Court to allow an extension. A decision on this is expected later this week. Andrea said, I'm absolutely so upset by this as it's another setback. And the last time we spoke to her, she'd been instructed to try and book tickets because, of course, she wants to be there. And in fact, it could have been sooner. So to try and book tickets that could be flexible in case she needed to be out in India sooner. And now she awaits to find out if the conclusion of that trial is going to be pushed back once again. Now, I'm one person and I know four young people, as it turns out, who are very keen to get on the road, given where we are, but to attend work and college. And I know one, my own son, actually, who was awaiting his test and it was scheduled. You know the way you can keep checking and you do keep checking. And it was for November 15th where he'd be invited to apply for a test, such as the way it works. And then just in the blink of an eye, it's been pushed out to the start of January. And it's devastating, really, when people rely on cars, as I say, to get to and from work. There is no public transport available to suit most people's needs, or even just to get their education, dependent on where they're going. This is an issue that's being raised by Councillor Jerry McMonagle as well. He is calling on the municipal district to contact the RSA on this issue. Now, not on this issue as it relates to me, on this issue more generally. Jerry, good morning to you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to everyone.
Yeah, so what are the latest figures telling us in terms of waiting times for people to get their driving test?
Well, according to the department, there's almost 10,000, over 9,500 currently in Donegal and learner permits licenses. There's 1,600 awaiting a test in the county, and there's 580 who are scheduled. But like you said, Greg, I've been contacted by a number of young people as well over this last number of months in relation to the length of time they're having to wait from they would sort of complete their course of driving test, which is enables them to apply for the test, to the time that they get the test, and then they're out the extra expense Some of them have been given 4 months of a time frame before they'd be invited to sit their test. And then, as you say, when they look in the portal, that's extended maybe another month or 6 weeks, and they don't know what's happening. They're obviously out extra expense. And if they're traveling to you, they're lucky enough that there's a bus service that gets them to their work, or there's their education centre at the times that they need to be there. So, look, what I can't understand is that in June last year, that the Transport Minister, Eamon Ryan, was approving a plan to do away with this continual application process for learner drivers, that they would continue with their learner driver until their test, instead of looking at the problem, which is the lack of testers, obviously. We haven't got enough. The demand is such that the testers are there demanded and are able to meet that demand. So rather than target the license holders, I thought he should have been investing in more testers to allow these young people an opportunity either to get to their work or to get to their place of education.
I seem to recall last year it being announced that more testers were being hired last year. And I think last week again they made another announcement that more testers are to be hired, and that's going to come into effect the middle of next year. It's kind of, are we there yet? Are we there yet? It constantly feels like people announce that stuff is being done, but the lived reality is that younger people, older people for that matter, maybe some of those that were on perpetual learner licences and realise that they need to actually sit a driving test and get a full licence, you know, all of those people can't get a test. And the reason why, and it was mentioned last week, Jerry, the reason why they're not cracking down on people perpetually booking tests to maintain the learner licence is because they're concerned that it would overwhelm the driving test system. That's a major problem.
Yeah, and it's a bigger problem in counties like Donegal and other rural counties, because we haven't got the transport systems that are in place in many of the cities. But you're right, it is perpetual, and there could be a lot of people who've been on learner driver licences for years and years because they haven't been able to access the test, and then they get out of the habit of waiting to do the test. It was handier to renew their learner driving permit, which is not a good thing, you know. And we see the statistics for road traffic accidents and deaths, and it's rising this year again. Personally, I think we need to look at the whole format of the driving test as well, and how that's done. Because the way I see it is done in managed areas and towns, very little of driving out on major roads, motorways, stuff like that. And these are where most of these accidents happen. The more serious accidents are not happening in town centres, where there's traffic going fairly slow, there's junctions, and while all that there is very good and it's necessary and it gets you them skills, but it's when you go out onto the 80-100 kilometre roads, 120 kilometre roads, I think that's where we're missing a beat there, Greg, you know, and I think that needs to be looked at as well.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a strange system whereby you can do your driving test. Well, let's say, for instance, you could do your driving test in Donegal Town, yeah. Right? And there's a few things you won't encounter. A, traffic lights. B, a motorway or dual carriageway. C, nighttime driving conditions. B, frosty driving conditions. And so on it goes. What to do if you aquaplane? How do you deal with that? We're not teaching anyone any of this stuff whatsoever. So someone then passes their test in Donegal Town, at least in Letterkenny, maybe you have to contend with the Polestar or something. But, you know, you're given a driving license and you're not tested in the majority of, you know, potentially high risk situations. It is a bit crazy. I wonder how many driving testers we have in this county, because sometimes it feels to me that if someone books annual leave off in December, you know, there's about 300 or 400 people are told that their lessons, you know, their test is a month later now all of a sudden. It does feel like that sometimes.
Yeah, and that's happening as well. And that's something I'm trying to find out now, is how many testers are per centre and, you know, where they are. And I hope they have that information shortly. But it's like, the left hand isn't talking to the right hand here, because all the applications are coming in. They have to be administered, they have to be collated, they have to be slotted into time. And then does the department not say to the minister, look, we're under extreme pressure here. You need to be getting more testers in A, B, and C. It's okay in Cork and Dublin because it's manageable, there's public transport. But in the rural counties, there's not. We need to increase the number of testers. And it says, whenever you write them about the delays, they talk about the emergency workers and all of that, and healthcare workers and stuff. But they say, but this does not include your community work. Well, if you're a healthcare worker and you're needed, then surely your community work is equally as important as when you land at your job.
Of course.
And the other thing is that your test can just be cancelled because, as you said, someone phones in sick or they take leave and you're not informed about this. And you don't be told until maybe a couple of days before your test.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work to be done by that whole department, I think. They need to talk to one another. And when they talk about they're going to take on 70 testers, it'll be the middle of next year probably. But they're only talking about the first batch. How many is that? Is that 10?
Yeah, but they said the same last year. This is a bit like the charging infrastructure. I'm a bit frustrated by these constant announcements that nothing ever seems to pass. What I didn't realise until very recently is that there is a cancellation. There is a cancellation part of the portal, which I thought was done away with, but it is there. But I'm not telling anyone how to access it until Aaron gets a test.
No, but you can't. Yes, there is that. But again, you're in a queue.
I know.
You could be given a date that mightn't suit you.
Yeah, I know. I know. Right. Okay. And I would love to know what this. I know you're putting questions in there, and you're going to ask all the questions. But I'd love to know, like, you know, if someone does call in sick, or if they're on annual leave, like, do they bring someone from another part of the country, or does that actually affect the waiting times? Because in this day and age, even just the inconvenience is there and everything. But from a road safety perspective, we really need to crack down on this too. We look forward to seeing what answers you get from. The representations from the MD, but also the other questions that you're putting in, because there's a lot of people listening today with a great interest in it. And I appreciate your time, Jerry. Thanks for it. Take care.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, bye-bye. That's Councillor Jerry McMonagall there. If that's something you're experiencing, let us know. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text. Just some further fallout from Budget 25. And, you know, I think the devil and the detail, or the positives in the detail, are only starting to emerge for some now. This from a small business person. Greg, no help for small businesses in this budget. I employ myself and two other people. The two ICOB grants, increased cost of business grants from the council, was denied to me because I'm in arrears on the rates due to two tough years in tourism. I offered to pay the council both grants in full and enter into a payment plan to pay back rates, and they denied my business the grant, stating it was because I was in arrears, which is difficult because the business arguably needs the most help there, and you're very willing to try and work with the council to sort it out. Very frustrating. So these helps for business from the government are lies for businesses that are struggling. Love the show. Thank you and the team for asking hard questions. I wonder how many other businesses were also turned down because they're finding it tough. Well, let us know. 086 60 25000. Right, we're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be back with our next guest in just a couple of moments. Now, funding worth €5 million for the group known as the Forgotten Farmers was announced by government as part of Budget 25. There are an estimated 3,500 farmers who lost out on vital farmer support due to cuts in public expenditure by the government following the last recession. Forgotten farmers typically set up their agricultural holdings before 2008 and were under 40 in 2015, but did not qualify for CAP supports, as had other young farmers at that time. Tom Boyd is of Lakeside Farm, Carrickfinn. He joins us now. Hi, Tom. Thanks for holding there. I do appreciate it.
Morning, Greg.
Right, so what's your reaction to the Forgotten Farmers £5 million announcement in the budget?
Yeah, look, I suppose this group have looked for this money for quite a while, and I know they've campaigned hard for it, but at the end of the day, there's nearly 20 years since these farmers were eligible for these grants. And it does feel a bit like the forgotten farmers, or really the future farmers, have been forgotten about in the budget. And I know they've allocated, $5 million for this forgotten farmer scheme to set it up. And I'm sure the $5 million won't cover what they're looking for over the next number of years. But I think really it should have been more aimed towards the future farmers maybe, and the money could have been better spent at the encouraging maybe an older generation to retire or hand over the reins of the farm, as they say. If you look there now at the statistics, really, the average age of a farmer is increasing massively. We're near 60 for the average age of a farmer in Ireland. And we're also, the amount of farmers in Ireland are decreasing. So for the amount of farmers are decreasing and the age is increasing, it only tells you one thing, that the young folk aren't getting involved in farming. And I know people say, oh, the younger generation don't want to do farming, they don't want the hard work, but there's plenty of interest by the younger generation, but there's no incentive from the government or anybody for the younger generation to get involved. And I understand too, the older folk aren't enough financially fit maybe to sign it over. They need to, they themselves look after, but I think if the government had to put some sort of plan in place for the older generation to slowly hand over the reins and that they were financially safe as they moved forward, it might have been better spent, really.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact details, but close to it. Over half of farmers have no succession plan in place. That was a study recently, wasn't it? I mean, that's crazy, isn't it? Do you think that's because there's not the support there, or what do you think's going on?
I think there's no financial support for farmers to retire, really, you know, and a lot of them too wouldn't have had any pension plans over the years, so they, you can't live on nothing, Greg, you know, and a lot of these older farmers have no financial plan, they've nothing, and I suppose there is an initiative now to try and encourage that, and there is meetings going on over the last number of years to encourage that, but there would need to be some sort of scheme for the government to encourage farmers to do that, maybe, and look, there's also the massive tax issues in regards to farmers handing over and all this, the implications as well.
They still need to plan because they might not have to worry about the tax implications when they're alive, but if they've got no will in place, whomever inherits their holding, they face significant tax issues. So it is always better, isn't it, Tom, to do that while everybody is alive. But you can understand why farmers don't retire either, because one in three do not have a pension in place, so that might be their only income to just keep working until they can't work any longer.
That's 100% what I'm getting at, Greg. I say very few farmers have any sort of pension. They can't afford to live off the state pension if they're eligible. So what can they do, really? They can't survive on nothing. So that's where I think the money would be better aimed towards a retirement scheme for farmers, or a succession scheme or something like that, where they could slowly hand over the reins. It would work out better for the next generation. As you said, it's for tax reasons, it's a lot easier to do it before, when everybody's still around. But as I say, the money now is being aimed towards the forgotten farmers. And look, I understand these farmers lost out on money back then due to, you know, the government again, the first cuts was for the farmers when the recession came, and I understand these farmers missed out on the grants, but I think it might have been better aimed if they had sorted something for the future farmers. And so we're just, every year we're falling year on year where nothing's been put in place to encourage the older generation to maybe hand over the reins.
I suppose, Tom, it all boils down to what the plan is. You know, I mean, and this is, I don't know what the plan is or if there is any plan. This is a question, it's not a statement. But, you know, how committed are we as a nation to, you know, continue to farm into the future? Or is our priority in, I don't know, data centres and electricity generation? I don't know the answer to that question. But I mean, unless we are committed as a nation to support our farming community, then why would you invest any money in succession planning or encouraging young people into the industry? You know, I think a lot of people could argue that we've lost really the fishing industry because there's at least two generations now that haven't gone into it for a number of reasons, but not least maybe some that you're paying to have boats tied up. Do you know that sort of way? So I suppose really we have to have an honest conversation about how committed are we to being a farming nation in 10, 20, 30, 40 years' time.
Yeah, well, look, we hit the nail on the head there, Greg. Is the government really committed to supporting Irish farmers? And it would appear to us that they're not really committed to supporting the farmers, and they'd be quite happy and 10, 15, 20 years that produce very little of our food here and we import it all. And I think maybe, as I say, the fishing industry has been now is basically dead in the country, and I think in 10 or 20 years we might end up with the same thing in the farming industry. And I know there's a lot of regret now that the fishing industry is gone here, basically. You know, myself here near Burton Port used to be a thriving fishing area, but there's basically nobody fishing out of it now making a living. And it's the same way, farming's going the same way. It appears the government are quite happy for the farmers not to farm, plant them up or plant them windmills or solar panels, and then we'll just import our food. But I think that when we get to that stage, we'll be an issue, because we'll realise then what we had and it'll be gone. The quality of the produce in this country far outweighs what we're importing from other countries.
I think it's good to have security in being able to produce your own food, your own vegetables, your own whatever it is. You know, we never know what way this world is going, and we could end up ruining the day. Farmers all of a sudden were very important when the invasion of Ukraine happened. You might recall that. It was like, right, we need you guys to dig us out here because we might need alternative supplies of certain stuffs, but that seems to have gone by the wayside. Now, there is quite a bit of support out there in terms of succession planning. You know, maybe the government needs to invest more in connecting farmers with farm advisors, or encouraging them of the benefits of it, or maybe engaging in schemes, or telling them how maybe there could be certain tax breaks in certain areas, like, so that, you know, farmers feel confident that they can either A, plan for the future, or B, it might be the decision not to. But do you think more needs to be done to sort of engage the farming community, particularly those of a generation, with the services that are out there, Tom?
Yeah, look, there could be more engagement and encouragement towards farmers. You know, the older generation are more of this, don't like to talk about the finances and things like that, but there needs to be a breakthrough in that, and to encourage them, and look, possibly more incentives, really, to incentivize them. A lot of them don't want to tie themselves down to contacts or, you know, sign up to anything in case of it might do harm and things like that. And if they know what they have, they know that if they keep doing what they're doing, they'll survive. So they're afraid of change, really. And there needs to be more work done on the ground, really. And more, I know Chagas do lots of different things there. They offer different seminars and things like that for farmers to come along and hear about the success and things, but there's no follow-through, I suppose, really. It's all well and good having these events.
Well, half of farmers have no succession plans, so whatever we're doing now, it's not landing, and it's not working, or it's not workable. There's something going on here, because that's a huge cliff edge. If half of the current people farming at the moment have no succession plans, and that's a national average. And sometimes I think, you know, it might be higher up here than it is elsewhere, such as the different type of farming we do, the size of the farms and what have you. All right, Tom, listen, an interesting conversation. We'll chase it up down the line, because I think it's something should be kept on the agenda. But for now, Tom, thanks very much for your opinions. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Tom Boyd there of Lakeside Farm in Carrickfinn. A caller says, hi, Greg, can you please ask your listeners about deer now we're in rutting season? I walk the forest here in Gwydor every day. People say I should not be in the forest now in rutting season. What is the story? Okay, so we have fantastic, well-learned listeners out there, many of them in the farming community. So a caller out walks the forest in Gwydor every day, loves it, but it's been told by a few people it might be a little bit dangerous because of it being rutting season. So what's the view out there? Tell us if it's safe for them to walk or not. Greg, what's wrong with the world? I passed a house last night and the Christmas tree, the Christmas lights and all was up. Come on, says the listener. With everything that's this the world at the moment, you know, it's going to hell in a handcart, you would feel. There's so much going on and so much misery in this world today. If that person gets one little bit of joy or respite from worries and strife by putting their Christmas tree up and their lights up, you know, I say fair play to them, because it can sort of feel like everything's going to pot. And I think maybe this person, we should all say, well, it might not be for me, the Christmas tree, but you know what, if that's what makes them happy, or maybe there's children in the house that there could be a myriad of reasons, but that they feel that they want to put the tree and the lights up now and it works for them, so be it. But for some, it does annoy them. And I know some people are annoyed by seeing certain stuff in shops as it relates to Christmas. But I know people very close to me that do Christmas shopping on St. Stephen's Day. So, you know, I'm well conditioned to Christmas coming early. All right, we're going to take a very quick break, and then we're coming back with an interesting proposal, and I wonder what you might think of this, from Fine Gael Senator Nikki Bradley, as it relates to how we rate our hotels. Fine Gael Senator Nikki Bradley joins me on the programme now. Good morning to you, Nikki. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Now, you've written to Fáilte Ireland urging that no hotel is to receive more than 3 stars without adequately catering for people with disabilities. Tell us more.
So this is something that I have, before I became a senator, it's something that I had spoken to numerous hotels about over the years as a motivational speaker. I was obviously on the road a lot, and I would always, when booking hotels, ask for an accessible room. So I like to think that at this point I have a good bit of experience visiting these hotels all around Ireland. And there were numerous things that always stood out to me that were very clearly designed by people that didn't have lived experience. And the more I saw it, the more it annoyed me. And as a crutch user, I'm somewhat limited, but I often put myself in the shoes of a wheelchair user. And I'm just going to give you a really quick example. So last week I was in a hotel in Dublin and I asked at reception where their accessible bathrooms were, and I was brought around the corner and I realised quickly that there was 2 accessible bathrooms, both of which were locked, and in order to gain access you had to, there's an actual phone mounted to the wall beside the locked toilet, and in order to gain access you had to ring a number which was basically ringing reception. Now, as we all know, usually when you ring a hotel reception, most of the time they don't answer, and that's exactly what happened in this situation. Now, again, as a crutch user, I always use an accessible bathroom. I'm an amputee. I need to take off my leg to actually be able to use the bathroom, and therefore I need a bigger stall. But if I was a wheelchair user, I would have no choice but to continue to ring this number and not have it answer. I was able to go and use the regular bathroom just because I had to. And I just thought in that moment, this is absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody is waiting to use the bathroom and they have to ring a phone number to gain access, to get a code to gain access, I just thought this isn't organized or designed by somebody that is a wheelchair user or has that lived experience.
Why would access be restricted like that, out of interest? Why would you not, on booking, be given a code, even if they did, for whatever reason, have to lock it? I don't understand, but why would...
Yeah, so just to even quickly explain why they lock it, yeah. And I understand why, and I agree with, in principle, what they're trying to do. So basically, they're trying to stop people misusing disabled toilets. People that don't have a disability often use them. We see it everywhere around Ireland, especially in our garages when we are on a long journey and we go in and try and use a disabled toilet, and you see that it's being used as a storage cupboard or it's being misused by the public. So they've obviously taken a stand to protect the bathroom. So I completely agree with that side of things. But as you just pointed out, and it's the perfect solution, give people access when they're booking.
Yeah.
Now, this was a bathroom. This wasn't, you know, obviously a bathroom in a hotel room. This was the lobby bathroom.
Yes, of course, yeah.
But the same principle applies. Give them that code so they don't have to then go up to reception, which is, you know, usually nowhere near the bathroom. And it was just, it's a combination of a number of factors that I've seen.
Anyone's going to the bathroom, generally speaking, you don't leave a space for having to ring a telephone number to then be given a code, to then input the code, to then get in. That's presuming the phone's answered straight away. That's not how it works.
And just to point out as well, if you're a wheelchair user, and maybe this is a bit much for 10 to 10 in the morning, but if you can imagine, once you actually gain access to the toilet, you know, a person that isn't a wheelchair user would simply do what they need to do and it's done in seconds. Yeah. If you have to get up out of your wheelchair and position yourself onto the toilet, that's adding more and more minutes onto it. And it honestly, at this stage, it just enrages me. There's so many small things that people that aren't, people that don't have reduced mobility or wheelchair users wouldn't even notice. For example, in rooms, there's no hook on the back of the door. So especially coming into winter, you're wearing a coat, you want to take it off, whatever. You have bags, whatever. There's no hook. And 9 times out of 10, if there is a hook, it's at standing level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the combination of these things that when I was seeing them in hotels, steps up to the front of the hotel, especially in cities because they're listed buildings, they just basically say the building is listed, there's nothing we can do. It's 2024, that's simply not good enough, that if somebody that's in a wheelchair or has reduced mobility cannot join their family on a nice weekend away in this particular hotel because there's steps up to the front doors.
Just in relation to the rooms, Nikki, because I presume, yeah. I imagine they're fewer in number. Does that mean they come at a premium or at least do hotels charge the same price for accessible rooms compared to the more plentiful rooms that perhaps aren't?
Yeah, I'm so glad you actually asked this because, again, I dealt with this about 3 weeks ago. I asked for an accessible room and I was told that it would cost more. And when I questioned this, they were basically said, well, the room is bigger, to which I replied, I'm not requesting a bigger room as a luxury. I'm requesting a bigger room as a necessity.
I take it they backed down eventually when you went.
This time they didn't. And I haven't been back since. And I made it clear that I would have been using their hotel on a weekly basis for work. And as a result of this, that I wouldn't be going back.
I think you've been very gracious there because I think they actually probably, and I'm not this, name and shame. I wouldn't do it for the wrong reasons, I don't think. But I think a hotel that is charging someone for a bigger room that actually really they should be saying, no, it's the same price. In other words, the reason it's bigger, it's for accessibility. So that's not justification for charging more, but you're not treating everyone equal.
It was described as an upgrade, which just absolutely baffled me. And then the other thing, and this is where we go back to why I felt the need to contact Fulcher Ireland and have this 3-star cap put in place. Because at the design level of a hotel or at a refurbishment level, that is where people with lived experience really need to be brought in. Because decisions are being made by people that do not have reduced mobility and therefore things are being overlooked on a really regular basis. For example, the location of an accessible room from the elevator and then the carpet getting you from the elevator to your room. So if you're a wheelchair user and we've all seen the carpet, we want
it's thick.
In normal life, we want that luxury, but wheeling across thick carpet.
No, it's like wheeling on a beach. And even if you're using a crutch as well, the give.
I'm pulling my suitcase in one hand, crutch in another, and the room is at the far end of the hall.
Okay.
Now that the room should be right beside the elevator. Like these are somewhat simple things to do at the early stages, and this is exactly why I want to draw attention to this, because if we can get in at the early stage when a new hotel is being built, it's a lot harder to change a room size or to change a location in an accessible room once the hotel has been built, obviously. But at refurbishment stage or at a new build stage, this is where people with lived experience need to be at the decision making.
Of course,
table
but in that with that with that in mind, and this is where it comes to legislation, and you're hoping to be a legislator post election in the Dáil. What are the planning guidelines? I mean, is this level of accessibility and some of the basic stuff, and it is basic, though very important to the people affected, are these conditions of planning now? So if there's a new hotel going to construction now, have we fixed these problems rather than sort of, after the fact trying to, penalise people with stars to encourage them to do this stuff?
No, as far as I'm concerned, there isn't enough of these guidelines in place, and that needs to change. And it's something that I'm going to speak to basically anybody I need to make these changes, because I'm honestly, Greg, I'm sick and tired of people with disabilities being overlooked or considered as an afterthought. We need to, you're exactly right, we need to get in there from the very beginning.
There should be no hotel, no school, no public building to be built at the moment that doesn't have fully accessible, not just toilets, but actually changing facilities, really. I can't understand how anything can go to construction now, particularly public, that does not have proper accessibility. I was talking to a listener last week whose husband now is a wheelchair user, and she lives in the east of the county, and half the buildings, at least, she says, that are run by the HSC, she can't actually access with any ease with her husband. You know, and that's the HSE building. So whatever about the private sector, we need to be getting it right from a public sector. But just in the last couple of minutes...
But it's actually everywhere.
Yeah, of course, I know, but...
Really quickly give you an example of a clothes shop actually in Letterkenny. Now, it's a chain, I won't mention them, but it is a chain. It's a British chain, and they do have a really good-sized, accessible changing room. They don't have... Now, bearing in mind, this is a clothes shop, so you're going in there for one reason. You're going in there to try on clothes. They don't have a single hook, not one hook in this entire place. I've gone in there and had to put my own clothes as well as the clothes I wanted to try on the dirty floor because there was genuinely no other option for me. And they have one seat. So again, anybody in a wheelchair or someone like myself, I'll have to sit down if I want to be able to try on clothes because I have to take off my leg, blah, blah, blah. The seat is in the corner and it's stuck to the ground. So it's hard to explain this on the radio, but if you are sitting on a seat and you are trying on clothes, you need to lean back to be able to take on and off things.
Yeah,
it's just
course,
a natural
yeah.
thing that yeah. you do while seated. This is a block of wood stuck to the corner, the very corner of this little cubicle. It's, you know, again, it's another area where it's been, where people that actually need this room haven't actually been considered at all. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a box ticking exercise where, yes, we have an accessible room, tick, let's move on.
Yeah.
I'm not even convinced that they're being tested. They're just, yes, that looks fine. Mm. They're being overseen by people that do not have any type of disability, and therefore the things that they need to look out for are being overlooked constantly. And this is genuinely across the board. Yeah. It's with our toilets are a big issue, but it's big everywhere.
And little things. It's big and little things too, and little things can be big things. Caller says shower
heads. Well, they really can. They can put an end to your day if you
yeah,
can't.
For sure.
You're out and about and you can't use a public bathroom, you'll have to go home.
Okay.
You know, otherwise, we know what will happen. You
yes,
know,
of
you,
course. Yeah.
And that's the end of, depending on where you live, that could be an hour journey to get home. And, you know, it's, and this is, I've spoken about this before, for a lot of people with disabilities, even going out and about and having that independence, that could be a conversation they've had to have with themselves that morning to force themselves out. We don't know what these people are going through. I know myself after my surgery that I had to force myself out of the house because I was worried if I didn't, I would never leave.
You become institutionalised in your own space. Yeah, just I have to go because of the time, but a caller says shower heads are always left at an inaccessible height in disabled bathrooms, so someone in a wheelchair cannot reach them. And that's
they're handheld.
Yeah,
they're handheld.
There you
that's
go.
Another issue.
All right, we didn't really get to what I thought was the controversial element of this, and that's not giving more than 3 stars for hotels that don't comply. But anyway, I think the wider conversation is a very important one, and I appreciate you having it with us. Have a good day, Nikki. Take care of yourself.
You too, thanks.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Fine Gael Senator Nikki Bradley, also Fine Gael General Election candidate.